This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. This is where we talk about the economy and your money. And we interview guest experts every week to present you multiple perspectives on what to expect moving ahead. And most importantly, give you some ideas to consider implementing in your own individual situation. Now, we do offer several free resources here for our listeners. And the first free resource I'd like to share with you on today's program is our Social Security Maximization Workshops. Again, these are free. For those of you that aren't aware, and this should be of particular interest to you if you're between the ages of 55 and 69, the Social Security collection rules were changed last year, and now they're even a bit more complex. So if you're trying to figure out the best way for you to collect your Social Security when the time comes, you have a whole new set of rules to deal with. We do have a couple of free workshops coming up. July 7 will be a Sunnybrook Country Club in Granville, and on July 12 will be at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant out on 28th Street in Grand Rapids. Both of these meetings begin at 6 p.m. and conclude with a complimentary dinner at 7:30 p.m. If you'd like to get more information or you'd like to register, all you have to do is visit the website socialsecuritydinner.com. The website again, socialsecuritydinner.com. On today's program, joining me momentarily will be Mr. John Kay. This was an interview that was supposed to air last week, right after the Brexit vote. However, we had some technical difficulties, so I am going to air that interview today. We'll get to that just momentarily. And then joining me in the second part of today's program will be Mr. John Rubino, who is the co-author with past guests here on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. James Turk, of the book The Money Bubble. So terrific program lined up for you today. And if you would like to listen to any of our prior interviews with the guest experts that we talk to here on the Everything Financial Radio program, all you have to do is visit the website, everythingfinancialradio.com. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, John Kay. John is one of Britain's leading economists. He chaired the review of UK equity markets and long-term decision-making. He is a visiting professor of economics at the London School of Economics and a fellow of St. John's College, Oxford. He writes a weekly column for the Financial Times. He has many other items on his resume and many other accomplishments that would take an entire segment if I were to mention them. So, John, let me just stop there and welcome you to the program.
Good to be here with you.
John, your most recent book, Other People's Money, contains information that really, I believe, is vital to listeners really all around the world. Can you explain what motivated you to write the book?
What motivated me was a sense that after the financial crisis of 2008, the analysis of the underlying causes of what had gone wrong were really quite superficial. And what had happened was really the result of a process over about 30 years, which I called financialization, in which finance had come to occupy a central role in our economies, and yet become more and more divorced from the real needs of the non-financial economy, of businesses and households. And it was to explain this divorce from the real needs that the economy has from the financial system, and to suggest some ways in which we could get that back, that I wanted to write the book.
So, John, let's talk about that term financialization. You described that as something that occurred over a 30-year time frame. Can you get into a little more detail?
Yes. What I think many people outside finance don't understand is the extent to which people who work in finance actually trade with each other. I give the various examples in the book about how the volume of trading in foreign exchange is 100 times the underlying volume of global trade in goods and services, how we now have so-called high-frequency traders. They're actually computers, which are trading with each other across lightning-fast telecoms links, and it's a computer at each end making the trade. And as you work that through, you start to ask, what is all this for, and why is it so profitable, or why is it apparently so profitable? Because one of the conclusions I reach is that a lot of the profitability of financial services is overstated.
So, John, you know, when we have talked to other guests and from my own research on the matter, one of the causes of the financial crisis was, at least in the United States here, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was an act that kept banks from being in the lending business and the securitization business. To what extent would you say that really played a role in the financial crisis?
I think that did play a role, although by the time Glass-Steagall was actually repealed in 1999, it had become not very effective. It was a gradual erosion rather than an abrupt repeal. But the final repeal of Glass-Steagall, and indeed its erosion, was part of the way in which the financial services industry lobbied for a certain kind of deregulation. And there's an important issue here, because a lot of people outside finance say that what we need is actually more regulation of the financial sector. Now, the truth is, in my mind, we have far too much regulation of the financial sector, but it's the wrong sort of regulation. What we've done is write ever more complicated rules for how these firms should behave. Now, Glass-Steagall, and thinking about Glass-Steagall, takes us back to what is, I think, the real central issue, which is we allowed the emergence of very large financial conglomerates, which are clashes of culture, conflicts of interest, and cross-subsidy across various activities. What we need to do to restore a more effective financial sector is to move back not just to Glass-Steagall and separation of commercial banking, retail and commercial banking from investment banking, but actually to separate the various functions of the modern investment bank itself. We need simpler institutions. A lot of people talk about too big to fail, and but the real problem has been too complex to fail.
Well, John, when you talk about the too big to fail banks, one of the things that pops to mind is the level of derivative exposure, or these side bets, to use a simple term, between banks, which would be completely
Absolutely.
Unregulated. To what extent is that an issue?
I think the problem is not that it's unregulated. The problem is really the scale of it, and it's a huge issue. So that the total volume of assets which are subject to derivative contracts today is about $600 trillion. It's a mind-blowing number. It's actually 2 to 3 times the value of all the assets in the world. And 10% of that, there are two banks that each account for about 10% of that total, J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank. It's a story that has got, I think, completely out of hand.
So, given that level of derivative exposure, and you made a statement that that's 2 to 3 times the total of all assets in the world, that is mind-blowing, to use the term that you did, how can we avoid another financial crisis?
I think with this structure, we're not actually going to. But what we need to do is to get this operation to wind itself down. Now, there's some value in some derivative contracts, and there's some value in some speculative activity in financial markets. But we need to do two things. We need to ensure that speculative activity, the derivatives activity, is subsidiary to the main purposes of finance, not the main activity itself. And we need to stop that being done in institutions which, in the end, rely on the backstop of the taxpayer, so that people are engaging in these wildly excessive exposures because people are confident that in the end, I talked about J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank, in the end, these are the institutions that are not going to be allowed to fail. If you didn't think that, you wouldn't be willing to trade with organizations that have the kind of scale of size of balance sheets that they do.
Well, we are chatting today with John Kay. John's book is titled Other People's Money. I learned a lot about John's work at johnkay.com. I would encourage you to do the same. And the good news is I have another segment to chat with Mr. Kay, and I will do that when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in today. Hey, if you've not yet attended our new retirement rules class, let me tell you about it very briefly before I get back to the conversation I had with John Kay. This is a class that's held on Saturday. The next class, in fact, will be Saturday, July 23rd. It begins at 9 a.m. and concludes at 2:30 p.m. And the class is just $49. We talk about retirement planning from every perspective. But in particular, we talk about how to plan for retirement given today's very precarious, very unique set of economic circumstances. If you'd like to get more information or register for the class, visit the website newretirementrules.com. I'm very pleased to be chatting today with John Kay. John is the author of the book Other People's Money, and we've been chatting with John about the financial sector, some of the issues and challenges in that sector. And John, in the last segment, you said something that I'd like you to expand on here, that you didn't say this, but you said it's going to be difficult to avoid another financial crisis. Assuming we have another financial crisis, what does it look like?
It's hard to say, because all financial crises are, at least in their immediate form, different. You know, we've had 3-4 major financial crises over that era of financialization, with the Asian market debt crisis and the emerging market debt crisis of the 1990s. Then with the new economy bubble in 1999-2000. Then with the credit crunch in 2007-2008. And at the moment, we in Europe have this Eurozone crisis, which is a really ongoing crisis. It has its origins in the financial sector, but it's dragging down Europe's economies. At best, it will go on dragging them down. At worst, it may burst into some larger crisis. So that all of these look different. But actually, if you go and look at the underlying causes, they're all actually rather similar. What happens is you get some real change in the underlying economy, the invention of the development of the internet, or the emergence of some Asian countries into the global economy, and people, convergence in the Eurozone. People who are early to see these trends make money out of it. Then people in financial markets, because they have this enormous herd instinct, pile into it. You get people making the short term lots of profits, but you get serious asset mispricing, which we saw that emerging market debt was being funded at much too low interest rates. Stocks were grossly overpriced in the new economy bubble. Credit expansion was being given to people who had no chance of paying it. Then all that gets corrected. And at that time, governments and central banks intervene to pump more money into the system in the hope of minimizing the damage to the rest of the economy. But all that does, it sets up fuel for the next crisis. And we can see some of the ways in which the fuel for the next crisis is there in China and in emerging markets and in the kind of bubble we have in the bond markets at the moment.
Let's talk about that. We have extraordinarily low interest rates. Would you say this is attributable, at least largely attributable, to central bank policy?
So I think it's almost entirely attributable to central bank policy. Both the cuts in interest rates, which were to low levels, which were made immediately after the 2008 crisis, and the pumping of money through into the system through quantitative easing, which has forced down long-term interest rates as well as short-term interest rates. You have low interest rates in Germany, in the United States. If you look to other countries like Germany and Switzerland, you can see that the Swiss government has been issuing 10-year bonds with a negative interest rate, and if you want a 30-year German government bond. At the moment, it will yield 0.7 or 0.8%.
You know, I was doing some research, and I read, John, that the last time that there were negative interest rates in Germany, you had to go back to the 20s, and we all know what followed that. We had a period of a significant currency crisis. So given these, you know, extraordinary policies of central banks, are we going to see currency crisis again?
I think we may see currency crisis. I'm not sure it's currencies that are going to be the next source of a major financial crisis. I would be looking at the two places of emerging markets and global bond markets. But we can't anticipate the nature and timing of crises. If we could, we'd do much better at avoiding them.
Well, that's a great point. As you're talking here, John, and we talk about the possibility of another financial crisis, here in the United States, we had the two big-to-fail banks that received a government bailout. When you look at some of the other measures that have been taken in countries like Greece, Cyprus, Ukraine, you've seen bail-ins where essentially depositors have lost some of the money they had on deposit. What do you see? Let's focus here on the United States. If we're assuming we see another financial crisis, is there a bailout that will occur, or do you think that the bail-in model might be more likely?
I suspect we're not going to find much bail-in when it comes to the point. I'm scared that these bail-in bonds are being issued to people who don't imagine that bail-in is actually going to happen. I further suspect that when push comes to shove, they will actually be right. The bail-ins won't be called. I fear that what we're doing is we're moving the point of bank rescue a bit forward so that central bank interventions come before banks get to the point of bailing creditors in. And frankly, in some places where these bonds are being sold to retail customers, I can't imagine that governments are actually, when it comes to the point, going to allow depositors, people who bought these bonds, to lose the money.
So when you look at, for example, here in the United States, Dodd-Frank, some of the regulation that was passed to try to prevent these issues from becoming issues again, and I think in the first segment you said that the regulation that has been implemented is the wrong kind, and there's been far too much of it. Is Dodd-Frank in that category?
Dodd-Frank is in that category. I mean, Dodd-Frank does some good things, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the issue we were talking about earlier, which is the creation of these two complex, culturally conflicted financial conglomerates. Unless we're prepared to look at the structure of the industry, we're not actually going to get effective reform. And for me, what we need is to replace enormously long and complicated regulatory rule books by simpler rules about industry structure and also personal responsibility for what goes on in institutions. One of the things that makes ordinary people angry about the 2008 crisis is that people at the top of large financial institutions that failed or came close to failure walked away with very large sums of money, whereas many people, including me, think some of them ought to be in prison. And I think what we ought to have is legislation that makes people at the top of institutions substantively responsible for what actually goes on in the companies of which they're in charge.
Well, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I think as a parent, we know that if you reward bad behavior, you get more of that behavior. So, John, just a couple, about 30 seconds left. If someone wanted to get their hands on your book, Other People's Money, what steps should they take?
Good bookshops or Amazon. You can get it either a print copy or ebook, and it's coming out shortly in the U.S. in paperback.
Perfect. Well, John, been a pleasure having you on the program today. We hope you'll come back.
Well, thanks, Dan. It's good to talk to you.
Well, that's all the time I have for this segment, but stay tuned. Joining me in the next segment will be the co-author of The Money Bubble, Mr. John Rubino. Back after these words. This is the Everything Financial Radio Program, and I am Dennis Tubergen, your host. Glad you decided to listen in today. In just a moment, I'll get to a conversation I had with Mr. John Rubino. Before I do, though, just in case you may be just joining me here on today's program, let me remind you of a couple free resources we have coming up here in the Grand Rapids area. On July 7 and on July 12, we will be holding free Social Security maximization workshops to share with you the new collection rules under Social Security. On July 7, we'll be at Sunnybrook Country Club in Granville. July 12, out on 28th Street at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant. To get more information or register, simply visit the website socialsecuritydinner.com. These free meetings begin at 6 p.m., conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. Again, the website for more information, socialsecuritydinner.com. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. John Rubino. John's website is dollarcollapse.com. I would encourage you to check that out. His most recent book, co-authored with James Turk, is titled The Money Bubble. And I also have had the pleasure of reading one of John's many other books, which is titled The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. And John, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Hey, Dennis. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, John, let's talk first about the big news. Stock markets, anyway, as we're recording this the Monday before this program begins to air, are reacting very negatively to the UK referendum, which had Britain voting to leave the UK, or the, excuse me, the EU. How do you see this playing out long term?
Yeah, well, long term is a harder call in Britain's case, Dennis, because it's not clear exactly how you divorce yourself from something like the European Union. So they've got a lot of questions to answer. In the short run, things are actually going well for them because the pound is way down. So they're kind of winning the currency war. You know, when your currency gets cheaper, it benefits your country at the expense of your trading partners in a lot of ways, because the stuff you're selling to the rest of the world gets cheaper because you're pricing it in your local currency, which is being devalued. And so it's easier to sell stuff to the rest of the world. You make more money, you hire more people. Generally, your economy grows. And so as far as that goes, Britain is seeing some benefits because its currency is cheaper. Whether, you know, pulling out of the EU leads to chaos in their banking system or whatever, we'll find out later. And, you know, nobody really knows. But I think what Brexit really represents is the start of a trend. And the trend is pretty disturbing because now seven or eight other European countries want to have referendums of their own on whether to pull out of the EU. And if that gains momentum, then we're going to see the single biggest economic entity in the world start to dissolve. That's going to be a really big deal for a couple of reasons. One is because obviously that'll cause a lot of chaos if it happens. And the other is that it's going to happen in piecemeal process over a long period of time where, you know, first it's France voting to leave, and then it's Spain, and then it's Portugal. And so this will continue for, you know, years before it plays out, which means there's going to be uncertainty in the markets for a really long time. And investors hate uncertainty, and so do capitalists. You know, if you're going to build a factory that's going to pay you off over 30 years, you kind of want a good sense of what the world is going to be like over that time period. And to the extent that the dissolution of the European Union makes it harder to predict what the world's going to be like, you're going to be less likely to build that factory. So growth slows down, equity and bond prices deteriorate, and volatility goes up. That's the kind of world that we're looking at if Brexit turns out to be the beginning of a trend, which it clearly looks like it is. So, you know, I think in a lot of ways, Britain had a point in not wanting to be part of the European Union, because that's really a badly run organization with a lot of, you know, fascist tendencies, frankly. But the result of what this thing kicked off is going to be with us for a long time, and overall, generally, the impact will be negative.
So, John, when I heard this news, and when you see what's going on worldwide now, I see some parallels between now and the early 1930s when you saw this whole protectionism movement, this nationalization fervor, if you will, rise. And as a result, world trade plummeted, and many historians would say it really exacerbated the symptoms of the Great Depression. Aren't we kind of seeing, you know, a second performance or a repeat performance then? It's just that the tools are a little bit different?
Yeah, we really are. This in a lot of ways is like the late 1920s, early 1930s. You know, you could make the case that we're already in a depression that that began maybe in 2000 with the tech stock bubble bursting, and that we're hiding the impact of the depression by being able to borrow money and create new currency, because now all the world's central banks have printing presses where they can create as much new currency as they want to, which they didn't back in the 1930s. And food stamps, for instance, in the U.S. are electronic. We just send people money, so you don't have these images of people standing in line for soup kitchens and things like that, like we have from the Great Depression. But we actually have more people getting public assistance now than back then. So in a lot of ways, something that historians will call a depression has already begun, and we're deeply into it now. And so in that sense, Brexit and the breakup of the European Union is part of the script that you would normally expect. You know, if we're in a depression, then you would expect protectionism and nationalism to be on the rise, because that's what you do when you're worried. You know, if you're really confident and you think the future is going to be bright, then free trade agreements and globalization seem reasonable. But when you're struggling for survival, you want to protect what you've got. And that leads to calls for protectionism and the rise of nationalist politicians. And we're certainly seeing that around the world. So I think in a lot of ways that are a little more subtle than allow most people to get it, we have entered a period of really, really hard times. And a lot of the politics that seem so crazy now are just natural outgrowths of an economic crisis. You know, when you see fringe political parties around the world move to the mainstream, you know, and become the big vote getters, like in France, where Marine Le Pen of the National Front is the most popular politician. Well, the National Front was kind of considered way, way out of the mainstream, extremely far right, and a very much fringe party just a few years ago. And now it's very possible that their leader is going to be the next president of France. And you're seeing that across Europe. You know, fringe parties are getting a lot of votes and in some cases participating in the governments that are being formed. And in the U.S., you've got Bernie Sanders on the left, an avowed socialist, getting a ton of votes and drawing huge crowds. And Donald Trump on the right, who is, I don't know what, but, you know, somebody who's clearly outside the political mainstream, who's now the Republican candidate for president. And so all of this is part of basically a package of a financial crisis that is due to us borrowing too much money and then just giving governments the ability to print as much new currency as they want to in order to finance all the debts they're taking on. And so, you know, that started in 1971 when the U.S. went off the gold standard and basically broke the link between the world's fiat currencies and anything tangible that would control their increase in supply. And so since that time, you've gotten pretty much what you would expect if you hand unlimited printing presses to elected officials and their appointed bureaucrats. You know, you've got a massive increase of debt year after year after year, and increasing financial instability and inflation in financial assets, which create bubbles, which pop and cause more turmoil. You know, that's where we are. And this can't end well. You know, it can only end with a major financial crisis of some sort. And based on the numbers, since the numbers in terms of the amount of debt we've taken on and the amount of leverage that we've applied to the global financial system, the reckoning should be commensurately huge. It should be bigger than anything that's happened in really human history, because the numbers have never been this outrageous. And so what's coming is hard to predict because it's uncharted territory. You know, we've never been this indebted at the same time governments have unlimited printing presses. So the craziness that we've seen up to this point are probably just foothills on the way to the mountains. you know, in the mountain is some kind of a crisis that is going to be hard for us to imagine and even harder to accept when it happens, but it does seem to be coming.
Well, the bad news is that's all the time we have for this segment, but the good news is we have Mr. John Rubino for another segment. We'll be talking to him about his forecast for financial markets and what it might mean for you and your money when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm Dennis Tubergen, your host. Before I get back to my conversation with Mr. John Rubino, let me remind you that if you're not yet a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter, it's easy to become a subscriber. All you have to do is visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. Give us your name and email address, and every Monday at 5 p.m., you'll get my market and economic update and commentary delivered to you via email. So again, the website to become a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to be joined today on the Everything Financial Radio program by Mr. John Rubino. John's website is dollarcollapse.com. I would encourage you to check it out. And his most recent book, co-authored with James Turk, a past guest here on the Everything Financial Radio program, is titled The Money Bubble. And John, in the last segment, we were talking about the fact that the debt levels are literally unprecedented, both in the public sector and private sector, and that issue is combined with another phenomenon, I guess, and if you want to use that term, that governments now have access to printing presses. History, though, teaches us that whenever money is printed, it can only be printed for a while before confidence is lost in the currency, and then the economic problems get even bigger. So when does the money printing stop?
Well, Dennis, that's the big question, because frankly, I thought 2005 or so was the end of the road for this current crazy financial system, but it's managed to hold on a lot longer than seemed reasonable back then, and part of the reason is that it's global. Every major country has an unlimited fiat currency printing press. In other words, they can make as much new money as they want to, and that power is great for fooling people. It allows you to manipulate interest rates to levels that make it seem like things are okay, and to intervene in the stock and bond markets and push financial asset prices up in ways that also make people think the world is okay. But really, all that's happening is that we're inflating the value of lots of financial assets by creating new currency. And that's not new wealth. That's just make-believe paper. And eventually, that kind of thing blows up on you. And what happens is people gradually come to realize that it's the explicit policy of their government to make their currency worth less year after year, and that they're going to continue to do that for as far as the eye can see. So people lose faith in the currency. They decide that they don't want to hold it anymore because they know it's going to be worth less and less and less. So as soon as they get paid, they convert their paycheck into real stuff. They go out and they buy land, or they buy gold and silver, or they buy, oil wells, or any kind of real asset that governments can't create more of, and the price of those things just go through the roof. And that, it manifests as inflation, but what it really is a loss of confidence in the currency. And when a critical mass of people start acting that way, the system spins out of control. And in the Austrian School of Economics, they have a term for it. It's called the crack-up boom. And I think you could make the case that we're in the early stage of that process, because already capital is flowing aggressively into things that are real. The price of London penthouses is at an all-time record, and fine art keeps being auctioned at higher and higher prices. And what that means is that the people with extra cash, the rich folks of the world, are converting that cash into real stuff because they don't want to hold it anymore. And as governments get into deeper and deeper financial trouble, like, for instance, what's happening in Europe and Japan and China and the U.S., the temptation to try to devalue their currencies really aggressively to get out from under their debts is going to become overwhelming. And we're going to hit the next stage of the process, which I think is coming soon, where as crazy as the last few years financial and monetary policies have seemed, the next batch will be even crazier. And that batch will involve massive new government deficit spending and even more negative interest rates. You know, in the U.S., conceivably, by this time next year, you'll be able to borrow money to buy a house, and the bank will pay you instead of you paying the bank. And once that happens, all bets are off, because we're kind of in an economic twilight zone where the old laws of finance don't apply anymore. And so the system will almost certainly spin out of control. So it becomes a question of timing. You know, does it happen late this year, early next year, or does it happen 2025? And that's what we can't know, because it's turning out that a printing press is such an excellent tool for fooling people that it allows these governments to keep it going much longer than they should be able to. In the meantime, though, for regular people, it makes sense to accept that this can't be stopped and can't be changed. You know, it doesn't matter who we vote for, and it doesn't really matter what we do in our personal lives. The institutional momentum of the global financial system is going to take us off that cliff. So for us, we need to be thinking about what we can do to protect ourselves and our families from this eventual crisis. And gold and silver are a pretty good bet and pretty accessible for the average person. You know, you can go out and buy some silver coins, and because silver, along with gold, are forms of money that have been around for 3,000 years and have held their value for a long time and can't be created in infinite quantities on a printing press. You know, you have to dig it out of the ground, and we only get about 2% more each year, and so its supply is constrained. Those things tend to hold their value because of those reasons. And so that's something an individual can do to protect themselves. You know, if you own a lot of gold and silver in accessible forms, then your capital will tend to rise in local currency terms. In other words, the dollar value of your gold and silver will go up in price, and that'll protect your purchasing power. You'll be able to continue to buy stuff to live a relatively normal life if you have assets like that that go up in value when the currency in which you're measuring them goes down. So, again, that's coming. We don't know when it's going to come, but preparing now for it is probably a good idea. And we're seeing that lately. You know, gold and silver really popped when the Brexit news hit. And the reason for that is that that's where we hide out in times of turmoil. And this is clearly a time of turmoil. So I think it's reasonable to expect, you know, with a lot of fluctuation, but the gold and silver to go up in a general trend for the next few years. So, you know, maybe it bounces around in the near term, but I think 2 years from now and 5 years from now and 10 years from now, the price of gold and probably of silver will be considerably higher than today.
So, John, one of the things that I like to look at is the Dow gold ratio, because it's got a lot of years of history. And when you take a look at, you know, where the Dow gold ratio has been at the end of other periods of turmoil, a lot of times you see the Dow and gold at a 1-to-1 or maybe 2-to-1 ratio. I don't know how familiar you are with the Dow to gold ratio, but do you see that you know, the Dow and gold could end up on par at some point?
Well, yeah, as recently as 1980, an ounce of gold would buy you the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And basically, what we're talking about here is a periodic shift between real assets and financial assets in the markets. And at times like this, we've had a long, long pendulum swing in favor of financial assets because governments have been actively inflating financial assets by creating huge amounts of new currency that flow into the stock market. And so now we've got what the stock market is about 12 times the price of gold. And the pendulum usually swings, as you said, back to 1-to-1. So from here on out, it's a pretty good bet that gold outperforms U.S. equities, and that eventually we'll get back to, you know, 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 or something like that, you know, somewhere around equality. And so over that long period of time, gold will be an asset that works for you much better than a diversified portfolio of stocks. So from, say, 1970 to 1980, even though the stock market went up, gold went up a lot faster. And it's possible that the same thing happens again. You know, the governments of the world inflate away their currencies, and that makes the stock market go up because we're measuring it in less and less valuable dollars. But gold goes up much faster. So it could be that, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average will be at 25,000, up from today's 17,000 5 years from now. But gold will be $20,000 an ounce, up from 1,300 today. So, you know, you in theory, you make money in either asset class, but you make a lot more money in the real assets because that's the direction that the pendulum is swinging for the next decade or two.
Well, that is going to, or the clock, I guess, is going to tell us that we're out of time here. Our guest today has been Mr. John Rubino. His website is dollarcollapse.com. His most recent book, one of many, is The Money Bubble. I would encourage you to check them both out. And John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Dennis.
Well, there is another New Retirement Rules class coming up yet this summer. It will be held on July the 23rd. That is a Saturday. It'll be held at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. The class begins at 9 a.m. and concludes at 2:30 p.m. The cost for the class, which includes the book, all the handouts, and lunch for you and a guest, is just $49. All you have to do if you'd like to get more information or register is visit the website newretirementrules.com. And you know, at the class we talk about certain times historically when economic conditions look a lot like they look today. For example, when one looks just at the recent Brexit vote. The vote that the British citizens had them leaving, actually, the European Union. This whole idea of protectionism and nationalism is nothing new. We saw something similar in the early 1930s when economic conditions worldwide weakened. Now, there's no doubt that economic conditions today are weakening. One need only look at the revised April jobs report and the May jobs report to see that. So we talk about what might lie ahead based on what's happened historically for the markets and what it might mean for you and your money. Really important class, really important information to have, and a really important perspective to have, in my opinion. So if you would like to get more information or register, simply visit newretirementrules.com. You can nose around there, or you can register while capacity remains. That's all the time I have for this week. Thanks for listening.